Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
I'm really excited to be here and look forward to both our discussion today and then the whole day of meeting with the incredible scientists here in San Diego. My lab is interested in understanding the molecular and cellular mechanisms that drive neurodegenerative diseases, and I'm sure nobody in this audience doubts the urgency and the need to develop better, more effective treatment against these diseases. And I think the reason that we are still lacking effective treatments for most of these age-associated neurodegenerative diseases is that we still have major gaps in our understanding of what the key molecular and cellular events are in these diseases. Although these are exciting times and we are making a lot of progress. One of the hallmarks of neurodegenerative diseases that we've known about as a scientific community for well over 100 years is the aggregation of specific proteins in particular cell types in the brain that are found post-mortem and that to this day are the ultimate way to define and classify which particular disease somebody had. Of course, one important question is whether these protein aggregates are in fact playing a causal role in disease or whether they're just some kind of a byproduct of a sick brain. And I would say there are, at this point, three lines of evidence that support a causal role for these proteins and probably something about the aggregation process in these diseases. Number one, for all of these proteins that aggregate in what we called sporadic patients, so these are patients who are don't have a familial inherited disease, there are in fact rarer cases of familial disease with mutations in the very same proteins that then aggregate. In some cases, it's been clearly shown that actually those mutations can make the proteins more aggregation prone. So something about these proteins can be causal, is relevant. We know from a particular class of diseases, infectious neurodegenerative diseases, that would include, for example, mad cow disease, scrapie in sheep, or kuru in humans, that my UCSF colleague Stan Prusiner has been studying for a long time. And when he isolated the infectious agent that transmits these diseases, it turned out not to be a virus, as people had hypothesized, but actually just a protein, and indeed a protein that pre-exists in everybody's brain, but a protein that can exist in more than one state. And it's this aggregation state that can actually template more aggregation, and that provides this amplification infectious principle that he termed the prion principle. And we now believe that protein aggregates that are actually associated with much more common neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so on, also can have prion-like properties. We don't think of these diseases as infectious between human individuals, but there is evidence, at least for mouse models, to suggest that prion-like spreading through the brain of an individual as the disease progresses might be an important factor in pathogenesis and disease progression. And then lastly, and this point is a very recent development, I would say, is that people have started to target these protein aggregates therapeutically. Actually, here at the Scripps, Jeff Kelly had been the first to come up with a treatment that addresses a peripheral amyloidosis, but also for these age-associated neurodegenerative diseases, we now have, for example, antibodies targeting A-beta. I think they have a long way to go to have better efficacy, but at least it's a proof of principle that going after these proteins can have a beneficial effect, disease-modifying effect. In ALS patients with a mutation in SOD1, where SOD1 aggregates, antisense oligos have actually been very effective, very recent data, so that's exciting. My lab is mostly focused on the protein tau, which is one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease when it aggregates, and also aggregates in a number of other so-called tauopathies, including frontotemporal dementia, but also, for example, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, so something that happens after physical impact on the brain. And so tau is a first described as a microtubule binding protein. However, it is a real shape shifter. It is an intrinsically disordered protein that can have many binding partners in the cell. It can bind to microtubules, certainly, but we actually know relatively little about its physiological role. We do know that it aggregates in all these tauopathies, and recent advances in cryo-electron microscopy have actually shown that tau can aggregate in distinct amyloid fibril shapes or conformations, he has shown as a cross-section in these different diseases. So that's quite intriguing. And so these findings now, for me, as somebody who is interested in the cellular molecular mechanisms, bring us up a number of question marks. What controls tau, you know, production and clearance? What controls its aggregation, right? Are there some factors, for example, in the cellular environment that control this process? I would argue the fact that there's a cell type specificity to where tau aggregates, even in patients who have a mutant tau expressed in all the neurons in the brain, right? It aggregates in specific cell populations, and also it aggregates late in life, suggesting that the cellular context plays an important role in controlling these processes. And then, you know, based on these observations of prion-like spreading of tau, what are the mechanisms by which tau can transmit between cells, trigger new aggregation? And then, obviously, the ultimate question is, what about this whole process is actually toxic to neurons, causing dysfunction and ultimately neurodegenerative disease? So each of these question marks is a molecular mechanism we'd like to understand. It's possible that some of the genetic variants that are now being uncovered in by human geneticists that modify disease risk, that some of them represent factors in this pathway. As I mentioned, again, the cell type selective vulnerability, why do some particular types of neurons are, why are they more sensitive to this, could be explained by some of these factors. And ultimately, of course, each of these question marks is a possible therapeutic target. And even if we could just delay the progression of the disease by a few years, that would already have a huge public health impact. How do we fill in these question marks? Well, there's no shortage of hypotheses in the field that people have been focusing on in their labs, but we decided to take a completely unbiased approach to try to uncover some of the relevant factors. And to do that, we leverage CRISPR screening technology. CRISPR needs no introduction, I'm sure, to anyone in this audience. The bacterial Cas9 protein in complex with a single guide RNA is a programmable nuclease to introduce DNA cuts, and this has transformed our ability to edit genomes, both in a research setting, but also now in a gene therapy setting. And when I was a postdoc myself in Jonathan Weissman's lab at UCSF at the time, we developed other tools to be able to leverage CRISPR technologies in other ways. We made catalytically dead point mutants of the Cas9 protein, dead Cas9 that no longer cut DNA, but that still can be recruited to DNA loci by the guide RNA. And so that then is a recruitment platform for effector domains, such as transcriptional activation domains, we call this CRISPR-A, or transcriptional repressor domains, CRISPR-I. And that enables us to control gene expression of endogenous genes over many orders of magnitude up and down. And because all we need to target a gene of interest is this short guide RNA, we were able to make high complexity libraries of guide RNAs and do genome-wide modifier screens, targeting, for example, all the protein-coding genes in the genome, but this importantly can also target non-coding RNAs or even enhance the regulatory regions in the genome. And our first screens were done in simple cancer cell lines for convenience. So when I started my own lab at UCSF almost 10 years ago now, we were very interested to do these screens in cell types that are relevant for neurological diseases. And so we decided to combine CRISPR screening with iPSC technology to be able to do these screens in human iPSC-derived neurons, microglia, astrocytes, and so on. And I'm not going to talk about these publications, but in each case, we were able to uncover some cell type specific biology with them. And of course, the excitement and promise of iPSC technology is that we can also work directly with patient derived cells and look for modifiers, for example, of relevant phenotypes. And I show you an example of that today. So using that technology, we have started to fill in some of the question marks in this pathway in published work. For example, we were able to define, in a collaboration with Ken Kosick's lab, the cell surface receptors that are important for tau to enter new cells. And while this was done based on these cell-based screens, for example, one of the cell surface receptors for tau, LRP1, turned out that when you knock it down in a mouse, it also blocks tau spreading in a mouse model. So that was exciting to see. My lab further followed up on what controls after being taken up the escape from the endolysosomal pathway in neurons, and in fact, in a collaboration led by my colleague at Berkeley, Jim Hurley, it became apparent that tau itself actually induces damage in this endolysosomal membrane, and that aggregates are nucleated at these damaged sites. So there's some ongoing interesting discoveries. But today I will tell you about new work looking at this other end of the process, the beginning basically of asking what controls the initial formation of tau aggregates. And this is work by a wonderful senior postdoc in the lab, Avi Samuelson, who will actually come to Southern California to start his own lab at UCLA in January. And a version of this is on BioArchive. As a starting point, we used iPSC lines that we had obtained from Lee Gann's lab. That was an isogenic pair where one of the lines had a mutation in the gene encoding tau called MAPT. This V337M mutation causes frontotemporal dementia, a tauopathy in humans. And Avi differentiated these into glutamatergic neurons and looked at the tau biochemistry. And while these cells do not spontaneously form insoluble tau fibrils, using conformation-specific antibodies against tau oligomers, he was able to see that they accumulate to a higher degree tau oligomers. And there's an interesting discussion in the field whether actually the large fibrils are in fact the toxic species. There's some evidence, including some very new data from Brad Hyman's lab, suggesting that neurons with these large fibrils are actually more protected, and it might be really these oligomer species that are toxic. So we were interested in looking at that. And Avi established a flow cytometry-based assay based on fixed permeabilized neurons and saw that in a kind of a gene dosage-dependent manner, he sees with the V337M mutant tau an increase in these tau oligomers with this antibody. So this was now the basis for a modifier screen. He introduced guide RNAs using lentivirus that targeted all the protein coding genes in the human genome into a pool of these iPSCs that also had the CRISPR-I machinery, differentiated them into a pool of glutamatergic neurons using the Neurogenin 2 system. And then he did FACS sorting based on staining for tau oligomers using this conformation-specific antibody. I should also say it's not shown here, but he also included a neuronal marker to nuN to just make sure that any perturbations that would block differentiation completely would not be included here. And so then he did physical separation by FACS sorting of neurons with higher versus lower levels of tau oligomer burden. And then on these two sorted pools, he extracted genomic DNA and did targeted sequencing of the guide RNA encoding locus to count essentially frequencies of guide RNAs in these two populations and ask, are there any genetic perturbations that would shift neurons to either have more or less tau aggregate levels? He found a lot of modifiers, so this is now showing a volcano plot of the phenotypes. Each dot is a genetic perturbation. You can see on the left that knockdown of MAPT, tau itself, was one of the top hits that would reduce tau oligomer levels, as one might expect. It's also a reminder that this screen would pick up both things that just modify total tau, as well as modifiers more specifically of tau oligomers. And as I show you in a few slides, we've done secondary screens, and indeed there are both classes of genes. I don't have the time to obviously take you through everything we found in this large screen, and I think it will give us and hopefully the community many more years of follow-up work, just highlighting the types of genes that were prominent. In purple, members of the ubiquitin proteasome system that is involved in marking proteins for turnover. These purple dots were mostly enriched on the side where knockdown gives you more oligomers, as one might expect if they're involved in tau turnover. Similarly, for the autophagy system, which is a known pathway for aggregate degradation, whereas this negative regulators of autophagy in light green were actually on the other side, and targeting them would actually help clear aggregates. mTOR was one example for such a negative regulator. Somewhat unexpected, we saw that a large number of genes in the electron transport chain when knocked down actually promoted tau oligomer formation. Again, no time to show you all the details. I think we also have to figure things out in more detail, but our data so far suggest that these defects cause reactive oxygen species, and there is some element of directly oxidizing tau that promotes a cleavage events, that promotes aggregation. For example, when we express a version of tau where we mutate all the oxidation-prone residues, we can overcome that that effect. So this is interesting partially because we know that in aging brains, mitochondrial dysfunction increases and there's an increase in reactive oxygen species. So it could be that even in these young iPSC-derived neurons, we are mimicking one of the hallmarks of aging here that drives tau aggregation, you know, and suggesting that this might be one of the reasons for the age dependence of tau aggregation. We also found other pathways that are actually when knockdown protective and lower tau aggregates that initially we had no idea how they connect GPI anchor biosynthesis, UFMylation, which is a ubiquitin-like modification pathway, and M6A writers. M6A is a post-transcriptional RNA modification, and those are all areas that we're very excited now to go more into. In secondary screens, we also probe with other independent conformation-specific antibodies for tau oligomers that detect slightly different tau species. And the good news is we saw a core overlap between these various secondary screens that were enriched in the same pathway. So broadly, these pathways are robust. There were some differences. Some of that might be technical noise, but it is also possible that there are modifiers that modify more precisely what exact types of tau species you get, and the different antibodies pick up on different tau species, something to look into. So next we wanted to know whether some of the modifiers of tau aggregation that we saw here might also explain selective vulnerability of some cell types to tau aggregation. As I mentioned, even in mutant tau, for example, some neurons are more likely in the human brain to accumulate tau pathology than others. And we went back to a paper that two students in the lab, Kuhn and Emmy, had led a couple of years earlier, where together with Leah Greenberg, a neuropathologist at UCSF, we did single nucleus RNA sequencing on human postmortem brains in the entorhinal cortex, as well as a cortical region of Alzheimer's patients and unaffected control at different stages. And in this studies, we were interested to define on the molecular level what are the transcriptomic signature basically of vulnerable versus resilient neurons in this early vulnerable region. And now when we overlaid those hits with our hits from our modifier screen in the model system, the overlap was not huge, and that was to be expected because, if you think about differentially expressed genes between any two neuronal populations in the brain, well, most of those differentially expressed genes are going to be reporting on the physiological specializations of these neuronal types, right? They didn't evolve to be permissive for tau aggregation, presumably. So we have, but then only a small subset of them might also affect tau. I mean, at the extreme, maybe one gene. So it was interesting to see now looking at candidate vulnerability factors, genes more highly expressed in vulnerable neurons and where the knockdown actually reduced tau oligomers, that the overlap was enriched in particular pathways. In this case, actually intriguingly, glycolysis pathways, there were genes like GAPDH, popular loading control, that were actually differentially expressed. Something to look into, and I know Jerome and Rusty have some beautiful work on metabolic changes in aging and in Alzheimer's disease. So I think this is an interesting area. But today I'll show you some more a follow-up on a different area. So when we look at candidate resilience factors, things more highly expressed in resilient neurons where the knockdown made things worse, This was enriched for this ubiquitin proteasome pathway, and one of the hits in particular stood out, which was a gene called Cal5. You can see here that Cal5 was one of the top hits, where when we knock it down, we get more tau aggregate burden. What is Cal5? Cal5 is E3 ubiquitin ligase. So these work as quite complicated protein assemblies. You see Cal5 there is kind of the centerpiece in the middle that recruits on one hand an ubiquitin on an E2 enzyme via an adapter called RNF7. RNF7 was also hit in our screen. It itself is netylated, and then it acts with other proteins like ALOBC, and then it has a substrate adapter, one of many possible substrate adapters, to recruit a substrate that's then ubiquitinated. So we validated that indeed knockdown of Cal5 and to a slightly lesser degree RNF7 would increase tau oligomer levels, but indeed it also raised total tau levels. So in this case, this seemed to affect maybe total tau, not selectively tau oligomers. Obviously E3 ligases can have many substrates. So this could be a very indirect effect where knocking this down affects protein levels of many things in the cell that indirectly affect tau. But an alternative hypothesis is that tau is itself a direct substrate for ubiquitination or turnover by this complex. So we asked, is there a physical interaction between tau and this complex by doing a pull-down experiment with FLAGTAP, Cal5 in our neurons. As a control, we used FLAGTAP GFP. The Cal5 pulls down other members of this complex, which is good to see. So the FLAGTAC didn't disrupt assembly of these functional complexes. And indeed, we pulled down some endogenous tau. So that was exciting. So there is some physical interaction between tau and this complex. But that doesn't prove that tau is actually a ubiquitination substrate. So we wanted to look more deeply into that. We did both ask, is there a specific region in tau that confers this dependence on Cal5 for its levels? And so we tiled different regions of the tau protein, inserted them in a ratiometric reporter that would report on degradation and looked at sensitivity to Cal5. We established that this is a proteasome-dependent effect. Full-length tau is accumulating when you knock down Cal5, but only one of these little tiles accumulates, suggesting that that contains kind of this determinant of tau degradation. But again, this was a cell-based assay. This was indirect. So I think the final proof would be an assay with completely purified components. So to set this up and reconstitute this, we would need to know what the substrate adapter is. There are many possible substrate adapters for Cal5 that have been reported, but if we map back to our screen results in purple where they are, only one of them, called SOX4, was actually a very strong hit. So that was great to see. So our hypothesis was SOX4 might be the substrate adapter. The graduate student Ruter Bose took on this heroic in vitro reconstitution, although I would say we got really lucky. My UCSF colleague John Gross had been studying Cal5 in a completely different biological context of HIV infection, where it acts with a different substrate adapter. So we had a number of the components, but Ruter and Avi purified SOX4 constructs as well as the tau recombinantly, and indeed could see in vitro that in a SOX4-dependent manner, we get these higher order ubiquitin chains associated with tau, and this is mediated by the N-terminus of tau, not the C-terminus, which was consistent with our mapping of the sensitive domains. And we also mapped by using mass spec with Danielle Sweeney at UCSF specific ubiquitination sites. So indeed, that suggested now that tau is a direct ubiquitination substrate mediated by a specific region, and we're quite excited to now characterize that further at the molecular, maybe structural level, and think about whether this might be a therapeutic target where maybe enhancing this interaction between the substrate adapter and tau, for example, by small molecule molecular glues, might help to promote tau turnover. One last thing on this story that was something, a technical thing that had bothered us, is that these flow cytometry antibody assays are very noisy, as you can see here. Since we had learned that Cal5 should affect total tau levels as well, we said, oh, well, let's look by Western blot because that's less noisy. Indeed, this is less noisy, but the effect size was much less by Western blot, which was disappointing and a little bit of a head scratcher until we realized that one of the differences in this experiment is that by flow cytometry, we're processing neurons and mostly putting the soma cell body on the flow cytometer. Versus by Western blot, we are scraping the whole well, including the axons and dendrites, right, which actually account for quite a lot of the mass as well. So is it possible that there were some differences between the action of Cal5 in these subneuronal subcellular compartments? So we grew neurons and in a chamber that allows us to physically separate cell bodies from neurites. This is just showing that indeed we can separate this quite well based on marker proteins. And we saw that the Cal5 protein was strictly localized to the cell bodies and really excluded from the neurites versus some, as you can see, some other proteins, actin and tau itself are actually in both compartments. And then we asked whether Cal5 knockdown would affect tau levels separately in these compartments, and it turns out that knocking down Cal5 has no impact at all on tau levels in the neurites, but then had quite a more substantial effect on tau in the cell body. So this is an interesting example of kind of a spatially controlled protein homeostasis. And since tau's normal function is thought to be in the neurites, it could be, whereas it aggregates often in the soma, it could make sense to think about Cal5 as a good factor to kind of counteract tau aggregation maybe in the soma. Is this true in other model systems? Collaboration with Lee Gan Lab, we looked at the PS19 mouse model of tau aggregation, where you can see in 10-month-old mice, this PS19, which expressed a human transgenic mutant tau, accumulates a phosphotau stained by, in green by the 88 antibody, for example, here in the hippocampus. But not in all neurons, right? It's actually, you know, quite selective for some neurons. So we asked, is Cal5 expression different between the neurons that are vulnerable or not in this mouse? And actually, there was a very strong difference if you just looked at Cal5 intensity between neurons that accumulate tau aggregates, which had lower Cal5 levels than neurons that were protected from accumulating these tau aggregates, consistent with the direction of Cal5 as a protective factor that we had postulated. This is a correlative experiment. We're now doing ongoing some direct perturbation experiments in the mice as well, which is obviously a slightly longer timeline. And given that our first human brain data was actually done on a relatively small data set on these entorhinal cortex samples, and in the meantime, there had been much larger data sets coming out from human brains, including the Seattle Brain Atlas, we also asked there, you know, what genes correlate with vulnerability in AD in this larger data set in the Seattle AD Brain Atlas. And you can see that on this histogram that the components of the Cal5 complex were actually shifted towards the higher end of correlating positively with resilience in this case. So positive means resilience here. You know, it's very noisy. This is looking at all cell types. But when you actually now do a more focused search and look at specifically a subtype of neurons that recently several studies have pointed to as a vulnerable subtype, these somatostatin interneurons, you can actually there see that there's actually a very good, surprisingly good correlation with expression of components of this Cal5 complex and vulnerability. So again, correlative data, but something we're quite excited about. Stepping back, there's many other pathways for us to look at. We did secondary screens for just modifiers of total tau levels. As I mentioned before, you know, Cal5 does affect both in the top right corner, total tau and tau oligomers. But there were a few things off diagonal that are more selective for tau oligomers and that we are now following up on. Uofamylation is an interesting pathway. And in a collaboration with Lee Gan's lab, she rescreened the top 1,000 hits from our genome-wide screen in a different model of tau that has more mature aggregates, and again, euphemilation strongly came out. So this is something we're quite interested in. So we filled in one of these question marks again here. I will briefly show you where we're going with this, because one of the interesting questions that I pointed out before is that tau can aggregate in many different ways. And while we have a structural description of that now, we really lack a mechanistic understanding of what drives the fact that tau aggregates in different conformations in different diseases, and also what are the functional consequences. One hypothesis is, again, that these diseases originate in different brain regions. You see three tauopathies and are in red and yellow how they spread from different brain regions over the disease progression. So they have different points of origin. Also, they look different. They have different cell types that they originate in to form these different structures. So then a hypothesis is that it's really the cellular environment where these tau aggregates first arise that creates the strain that then spreads in this prion-like manner. So that would be our hypothesis, and then obviously we'd love to know what are these tau conformation specific regulators. This is very much work in progress. I'll just share with you the types of models that we're developing to address this question, and that's led by Sarah Kaufman, a physician scientist in the lab. Sarah has created iPSC lines that actually express not only 3R but also 4R tau. This is a splice isoform that is often found in more mature neurons and important in a lot of these aggregates. And she actually made versions that also express a fluorescent protein pair, green and red, that can have a FRET signal when proteins are in close proximity. So this is at the same time a convenient reporter of aggregation. So at baseline, these constructs are diffusely distributed, and by flow cytometry, there's no FRET signal. And then she goes in and seeds with human postmortem brain-derived tau seeds from these different tauopathies to establish models for these different strains. And indeed, she can isolate lines that very stably propagate tau aggregates and have a robust FRET signal here. When she differentiates them to neurons, they stain for phospho-tau markers and also for conformation-specific markers, MC1 here, that are picking up on slightly more advanced tau pathology. Biochemically, she gets insoluble tau from these neurons that is also hyperphosphorylated. And with my colleagues at UCSF, Greg Mertz and Dan Southworth, we are characterizing them structurally by isolating the fibrils, doing some electron microscopy, first by negative stain, where we confirm that there are indeed fibrils. And we have ongoing cryo-EM work to get higher resolution structures to see, can we get models where the fibrils that these neurons make match the conformation of the input material, which we still have from the same patient, so we can do that comparison. And then another method that we're very interested in to get at this interaction between tau, different tau strains in the cellular environment, and how maybe some of our genetic modifiers change that, is to look at them in high resolution in the cellular context as opposed to isolated fibrils. So for that, we're taking advantage of some really cutting edge technology, again with Dan Southworth, Greg Mertz, Arthur Mello here at our institute, where we do correlative light and electron microscopy using the fluorescent tags to localize regions where we might have tau aggregates, and then using focused ion beam milling to create windows to then do cryo-electron tomography on them. And this is some preliminary segmentation data, but it shows that we can then detect these fibrils in the cytosol. Intriguingly, in a different region that was less broadly fluorescent, we found that a different pictures where tau fibrils are densely packed inside membranous compartments. Based on some stains, we think this could be endolysosomal compartments. The shape doesn't add up, but it might be distended by these tau fibrils. So that's very intriguing. There's some data, and it could represent a number of things. It could represent attempts of cells to clear tau aggregates, maybe by autophagy, but it's not very efficient. They accumulate. It could represent species that have been spreading and get in through the endolysosomal pathway. But there is also some intriguing data, for example, from recent data from TMEM106B and TDP43. These are aggregates that are associated with FTD and ALS that maybe even inside the lysosome is where some of these aggregation events actually initiate. So it's just a teaser. Hopefully I can soon have more mechanistic insights, but those are some of the models that we're developing. So in the last part now, I will switch gears. We've been talking a lot about the biochemistry of tau, but ultimately the really important question is how do these processes ultimately affect neuronal function and neurodegeneration? And what is the readout we should look at? We can obviously look at neuronal survival, and we have done that. But there's obviously some questions for how neuronal survival in a dish translates to a true neurodegeneration process in the brain. brain. When we look back, and this is an older study, but I think still really informative study, what are the cellular molecular events that best in a patient brain that best correlate with cognitive decline? You have in Alzheimer's disease, A-beta plaque accumulation has a positive correlation, but it's not that stunning. And there are many cases where elderly people have lots of amyloid plaques in the brain, yet they are cognitively normal. Neurodegeneration is better correlated, so that's actually looking at loss of neuronal cells, so it is obviously relevant. Tau tangles, looking at tau pathology, is in fact slightly even better correlated, but the best thing that correlates is synapse loss, so loss between neuronal connections. So we were excited to think more about that, and an MD-PhD student in the lab, Kunal Shroff, is leading the charge on trying to understand what molecular mechanisms drive synapse loss. And first of all, of course, working with iPSCs, you know, I'm sure many of us have heard that criticism is like, are the neurons mature? Are the synapses mature? So we spend some time optimizing iPSC systems to optimize that for this project. For example, culturing high-density co-cultures of iPSC neurons with iPSC astrocytes, or all human system, and looking at expression of pre- and postsynaptic markers that go up with time, and importantly, the co-localization really goes up with time. So that's just structural evidence, but we can look functionally as well, for example, by growing these on multi-electrode arrays. So this just measures field potential. It's not a single cell resolution readout of neuronal activity. But what you can appreciate is that, you know, from going from day 7 to day 21 and looking at signal across electrodes, you get these very highly correlated bursts across the whole well. And indeed, when we treat them then with tetanus toxin, which specifically abrogates synaptic transmission, we can get rid of not the activity overall, but the synchronized firing, suggesting really that there is a lot, this is really driven by synaptic activity. This is shown here in a more longitudinal way as well, both spikes, but also importantly, a synchronicity increases over time, but is inhibited by tetanus toxin. Okay, so we think we have a system that is a good starting point now to look at synaptic phenotypes. Of course, how do we characterize synaptic phenotypes? Electrophysiology would be the gold standard. Microscopy might be good, but none of these are very high throughput to combine with these genome-wide screens. So one way to look at synapses in high throughput is to use, you know, build on some really old traditional protocols to actually biochemically fractionate and isolate synaptosomes or synaptoneurosomes, which are particles that you can fractionate from neuronal cultures or brains, and that include components of the pre- and postsynaptic compartments. These are not the cleanest preps. They often have cellular debris, mitochondria, other things in there. One way is to clean them up is to take advantage of the fact that synapses are actually highly active in membrane uptake as they recycle, for example, synaptic vesicle membranes. So we can do a pulse trace experiment, labeling with membrane dyes, FM dyes, for a while, and then washing them out. And so generally, cell membranes will be stained by these dyes, and we can wash them back out. But in true synapses, we will get uptake of the dye through these active processes, and then sorting on that fluorescence can help us gate on true synapses. As one would expect, the number of these particles or percentage of these particles also increases as the culture matures, and we can confirm that also by genetically encoded markers that localize to the pre- or post-synapse and that are enriched in these dye-positive compartments. Okay, so we can look at synapses, but what in synapses do we want to look at? Synapse loss is obviously something that in a dish is again slightly harder to model. And so one of the exciting developments over the last 10 years or so has been the recognition that synapse loss is not just in neurodegeneration, it's not just some kind of, I would say, more passive atrophy process, but indeed glial cells, microglia, but also other glial cells, astrocytes, play an active role in that, as they presumably do in synaptic pruning and development. And there's some key papers where people show that synapse loss in mouse models of Alzheimer's disease is dependent on glia and also, for example, the complement system. I would say that, you know, how to interpret that, there are some caveats. My colleague at UCSF, Anna Moloski, wrote a very nice review to point out that most people think of this direct engulfment. There could also be, in addition, some more indirect mechanisms. But anyways, data suggests that this engulfment, at least in mouse models, can play a role. So what are the molecular features that determine that? We can learn from in looking at the cousins of microglia in the periphery, the macrophages. They engulf, for example, apoptotic cells through a variety of receptors, but one of the key signals on the target cell is externalized phosphatidylserine. So this is a phospholipid normally localized asymmetrically in the inner leaflet of the plasma membrane, but in apoptosis it's flipped out across the cell, and that is a key signal for engulfment. Indeed, experiments in our hands and other people's work suggest that this is also probably an important signal for synapse engulfment. But what we wanted to understand is what is upstream of phosphatidylserine flipping out at specific synapses, and how does it mark individual synapses for engulfment, right? Because this is clearly different from apoptosis, where the entire cell exposes this, right? And so I think we are really excited to try to understand that process of marking individual synapses for engulfment and loss. We can measure phosphatidylserine in our isolated synaptosomes, and there's actually some dynamic range. For example, treating with amyloid beta, we get an increase in externalized phosphatidylserine on synaptosomes. Treating with tetrodotoxin, which blocks neuronal activity, we get a decrease, and this is following published work from people in other systems, and so we have some dynamic range here. So that would then lend itself to a readout for such a CRISPR screen. We just have one problem. In our CRISPR screen, the way I showed it, for example, for the tau pathology, we're doing FACS sorting where we mostly lose the neurites and with that the synapses, right? Or we just have the cell bodies. We need the cell bodies because the guide RNA is integrated in the nucleus, and that's what we sequence in the end. So how could we look at a peripheral phenotype? We can do FACS sorting on the synapses, but then we don't have the nuclei associated with that. So Kunal came up with a clever strategy where he engineered a guide expression system that, as we generally do, has a small RNA promoter, polymerase 3 promoter, making a guide RNA that can be active and repress genes in the nucleus. But an upstream promoter, true promoter, also drives a read-through transcript that encodes a copy of the guide RNA, but also a structured RNA element, the box B motif. And the box B motif has a protein binding partner called N-lambda. And now he can express N-lambda fused to proteins that carry this to other places in the cell, including the pre- or postsynaptic membrane. And the idea then is that this can kind of bring a copy of the guide RNA to the synapse where we're going to read out the phenotype, such that we can read out what was the gene perturbed in the cell that this synapse came from. The synaptosome came from. And indeed that works. We get enrichment of guide RNAs at the synapses. And so that allowed him to do a screen introducing this specialized guide RNA library into iPSCs, making neurons, staining with a dye for phosphatidylserine, then preparing the synaptosomes, sorting them on phosphatidylserine levels, and extracting guide RNA sequences to ask, were there any perturbations that would increase or decrease phosphatidylserine at the synapse. This screen is a pilot screen. It's several thousand genes, but it was somewhat noisy, and we've made many incremental improvements and have now a genome-wide screen ongoing. But as I will show you, we were very encouraged by what we saw already. One of the hits that you might see in the top right corner is a gene called ATP8A1. This indeed is a protein that is called a flipase, and its known function is to flip phosphatidylserine from the outer leaflet to the inner leaflet using energy. So that is actually responsible, along with some other flipases in the cell, for this asymmetrical distribution. When you knock it down, you get more exposed phosphatidylserine. We validated that, so that was a nice positive control. We also find things on the other side. So raw alpha, for example, knockdown reduces phosphatidylserine. This is a nuclear receptor. It's considered an orphan receptor because we don't know all about this ligands. But for example, 25-hydroxycholesterol, a metabolite, is thought to be important in Alzheimer's disease, is actually acting on this. And Again, we can validate that knocking down RORA now decreases phosphatidyl serine, and there are also inhibitors of RORA, and that pharmacologically very much have the same effect. Some other hits that were interesting, one of very strong hits was IL-11RA. This is a subunit of the IL-11 receptor. We started to work on this just because it was a strong hit, although it has not at all almost been looked at in the context of the brain. And then a few months ago, a paper made a big splash that said that IL-11 signaling actually goes up with aging, and inhibiting it is beneficial in mice. They again did not look at the brain, and our data might suggest that maybe it's not so good to inhibit it. So when we knock it down, we actually get a very substantial increase in phosphatidyl serine. And intriguingly, this increase was really specific to the synapses. The phosphatidyl serine in the cell body does not go up, suggesting that this is one of those selective mechanisms controlling signaling at the synapse. And we can have the opposite effect by treating with purified IL-11 beta, and some of the downstream factors also come out. So there are many other pathways that play a role that we are looking into. The other question is, of course, we were very much looking at a proxy phenotype here of phosphatidyl serine exposure in isolated synaptosomes. Does it actually affect synaptic pruning? Olivia Tieder, a bioengineering student in the lab, established a co-culture assay between iPSC-derived microglia, you can see them here with the white membrane dye, and neurons. In this case, they have a presynaptic protein labeled in green. As you can see, the microglia are very active as they are probing their environments, and these circles that pop up are phagocytic cups that really concentrate this membrane dye and that are probing the environment to take up material. And you can definitely capture events where green material from the neurons is taken up and internalized into the microglia. This is nice to see. It's very low throughput, so instead we also have a high throughput readout for this, where we are basically co-culturing microglia and astrocytes that are differentially fluorescently labeled, and the neurons express again this fluorescent protein synaptically. And then what we can do, we can isolate the cells by flow cytometry and ask how much synaptic material from neurons was taken up by microglia. This is actually dependent on phosphatidyl serine, so if we add annexin-5 to this culture, we drastically reduce this uptake process. But then when we knock down IL-11RA in the neurons, you can see that the microglia are able to take up more synapses, consistent with the idea that this increase in phosphatidyl serine from our original screen is functionally relevant for this uptake assay as well. So, and I should mention, I know that some in the audience are glia aficionados. We have also many studies looking more at glia themselves, in particular, what controls disease states of glia, how does it change their cell biology. Today, I didn't have time to show that, so apologies to those who are more interested in glia than neurons, but going forward, we're very interested in this interplay between neurons and glia in neurodegeneration. And just one last slide, while this is a stem cell group, I showed you all stem cell work to this point, but I should say that we also have now built a very scalable mouse brain in vivo screening platform, which is a nice complementary way to look at these phenotypes. And if you want to know more, that's on BioArchive. So with that, I want to thanks to my lab and our collaborators, funding sources, and you for listening. And I'm looking forward to any questions.
I'm just curious about what is known about post-translational modifications in aggregated versus non-aggregated tau.
That's a great question. And we know that there's a broad correlation, for example, between hyperphosphorylation of tau and aggregation. Cause and effect there are not so completely clear, right? Are some of the proteins first phosphorylated and then aggregate? There's evidence for that, partially because hyperphosphorylated tau often dissociates from microtubules and then more of it is free to aggregate. But there could also be events that happen post-aggregation, and there's many different, not only phosphorylation site, but sites for acetylation and other types of modifications. I would point you to the work of, for example, Judith Steen, who has done extensive mass spec studies in human brains and mapped post-translational modification sites of tau in different brain regions in different disease states. And there's a big catalog. But I think, again, it's correlative at this point, and we'd love to understand the functional roles.
Right, this is not a question, just a comment. It's intrinsically disordered domain structure is going to be modified quite a bit by post-translational modifications. So.
Absolutely. And so, you know, one of the things we were interested in finding in our screen as well is enzymes that might introduce this post-translational modifications, because that could give a hint that some of them might causally contribute to aggregation. And we have some enzymes, right, that we are now looking into.
It's a very nice talk. So I had two questions. Number one is, when you using cryEM to look at the tau structure, oligomer taus, is in a culture cells. What that look like in the synapse, like presynaptic terminal? Do you see the tau oligomer tau very much like what you see in the cell?
Great question. So unfortunately, the oligomer, we've had a hard time to isolate and enrich enough for structural studies. And that's been an ongoing problem in the field. So what I was showing you was from our second model, where we really have seeded aggregates that have abundant fibrils. And those we can then characterize structurally. We would love to have a structure for the oligomers. And I think many people in the tau and structural community would like that. But I think at this point, it's been a little elusive. And even in our neurons, I think it's not as very abundant species. It's not very stable, maybe. And so so that was a little frustrating for us, because we had to rely on these conformation-specific antibodies as opposed to having a clear structural definition. Having said that, it's, you know, there's evidence suggesting that functionally they're quite important. So we're excited about them. But yeah, they've been hard to characterize structurally.
Thank you. That brings my second question is, when you using the human V337M iPS-derived neurons, how that affect the synaptic activity when you measure on MEA?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have characterized that, and we do see that there is, a hyperexcitability phenotype in these V337M neurons. And we're not the first to describe that. Li Gan had a paper around changes like that, and people working on other genes and mutations, for example, APP presenilins, have also observed hyperexcitability phenotypes. And indeed, I didn't have time to talk about that, but we have a whole modifier screen also to try to understand that based on readouts. Mm-hmm.
Hi, very nice talk. In the end, when you were looking at the microglia, to me, that I'm thinking about that as almost like a response, right? You know, less causative. But at the very beginning of your talk, you had the electron transport chain, reactive oxygen species. A little bit later, you had 32 genes that were responsible for vulnerability, and 20-some that were responsible for resistance. Have you looked at that trifecta, things that are vulnerable, the things that have resistance, and the reactive oxygen species, to see if there's any correlation? Because I think I agree with you that, you know, aging is just, well, it's aging. And the reactive oxygen species are very much closer to the causative size.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, you know, a number of the genes that were in that overlap. And I would say, you know, this analysis of what might contribute to vulnerability in the human brain is obviously hypothetical at this point. We think of this as hypothesis generating, looking at that overlap. It's not proof that it is responsible for that. But intriguingly, we did see that there was this balance maybe between glycolysis and mitochondrial usage, that people have seen shifts in AD as well that might affect ROS levels. And some of that was apparent also when we looked at the resilient versus, some of these differences were apparent in resilient versus resistant neurons. So we'd love to probe that further and try to understand if that causally contributes to resilience. And again, some of that might make also sense to do in the context now of mouse models, where we do it in the context of a brain as well.
Well, there's one on Zoom complimenting you on a great talk and saying that the questioner recognized that you didn't have the opportunity to talk about glial cells or astrocytes, but wondering whether you could just briefly summarize, without slides, what you think the role of astrocytes are in this.
Yeah, great question. The people have known since again, the early days of Alzheimer's, that glial cells undergo massive changes. In Alzheimer's disease, for example, microglia accumulate lipids, they change their morphology, right? And the question is that just a downstream consequence, right? They're just reactive somehow, or are they also drivers of disease? And I would say more recently, over the last 10 years or so, human genetics of late onset sporadic Alzheimer's disease has uncovered genetic risk variants that are risk promoting. And there, I think a big surprise was that a lot of those risk variants seem to be implicated in microglial biology function. We also have a few kind of coding mutations, for example, in TREM2, which is a key receptor on microglia that affects whether they transition to a more disease-associated state, that seems to play a big role in, as a risk factor. So there's a lot of attention now on microglia, and whether they're the origin of the disease, I would doubt that, but I think they play a really important role in how the disease plays out by reacting to the disease process. They very much react to amyloid beta, for example. They shift their states, and some of these changes in their states might be beneficial in disease because they become better at counteracting some of these processes, but some of the other changes might also be toxic, right? And so one of the things we're interested in is understanding the functional implications of these states and what controls them to try to, you know, maybe one day even think of targeting the glial cells therapeutically to steer them in the right direction.
What about the role of astrocytes in either making synapses, preserving synapses, or allowing them to degenerate?
Yeah, astrocytes, and sorry, I talked mostly about microglia, partially because the human genetics. Astrocytes are clearly key cell types in the brain, especially around synapses, right? The tripartite synapse, the astrocytes plays a really important role, in, including in the iPSC models, to actually make and maintain functional synapses. And astrocytes are also one of the top producers of ApoE, where, again, mutations in ApoE are tightly associated with AD risk. So again, I'm sure astrocytes play an important role. They become reactive and lose some of their beneficial functions, possibly also some nice work from Shane Littlow's lab gained some toxic functions in this context. So they are also going to be key players. And especially exactly in this context of synapse loss, astrocytes are also cell types that can remove synapses. So I think in that context, too, they might play important roles.
I have a question for you while we're waiting for maybe more questions to come up. So back to the neurons, to your aggregation modifier screen where you sort it into tau-22 high and low cells and look for enrichment of the guide RNAs. You did a great job of mapping those like to different pathways, for example, OxPhos and autophagy. Did you also look at just compartmentalization of like proteins that are generally expressed? For example, you did that for mitochondria, basically, with the OxPhos genes, but also systematically looking for dendritic, axonal, maybe nuclear genes, and see if a certain compartment or compartmentalized proteins are more associated with pro or anti aggregation function, perhaps?
That's a great question. It's really the mitochondria that very much stood out in that regard as a compartment. You know, some of the other things, for example, GPI anchor biosynthesis is a process in the endoplasmic reticulum, and the uFMLation pathway is also linked to the endoplasmic reticulum, which was interesting because tau is not generally necessarily at the endoplasmic reticulum, right? But thinking about what that might mean is something we want to do. The autophagy things that I showed are obviously kind of linked to the autophagy and endolysosomal system. So it does definitely points to different areas of cell biology. But you're asking specifically also, dendritic compartment.
Also nucleus, which is maybe more surprising.
Nucleus, yes. There are definitely some things exactly acting in the nucleus, and they might be pretty upstream, right, and have indirect consequences on gene expression of other factors, right? So we need to work that up. But yeah, I would say we did not necessarily get a strong enrichment for things maybe in axons or dendrites at this point, but certainly some things that act in those compartments.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.